Live from the state capitol with Fred Dicker here on Talk 1300.
Well, as noted earlier, when I first came down to the state capitol, lo, those many years ago, just over 30 years ago, was to cover Hugh Carey as governor. And boy, what an experience that was. You had to be around him all the time because you never knew what he was going to do. Back then, the press actually traveled with a governor. We had frequent, and it was taken for granted, access to the state aircraft. We would fly with the governor. The governor actually lived in Albany. Get that. He was at the mansion, involved in very serious events. And I had come down here in the aftermath of the great New York City and state fiscal crisis, when Hugh Carey was a very serious national figure and given great credit for all he had accomplished. He came out of a distinguished background as well as a congressman, businessman, and as a World War II award-winning or medal-winning hero soldier who had, among other things, had been at the Remagen Bridge that was captured. The bridge across was at the Rhine leading into Germany. And he was a kind of sacrosanct figure, and I started writing some critical stories about the governor. And boy, he brought the house down on top of me. And it was a very interesting lesson, high-quality people around the governor. And I was thrilled to be covering Hugh Carey back then. And since then, in my view, it's, and the view of a great many people, it's just been a decline for the state. There's a new book out dealing with Hugh Carey, as previously noted, The Man Who Saved New York, Hugh Carey and the Great Fiscal Crisis of 1975, co-authored by Seymour Lachman, who's the lead name on the book. And Seymour Lachman was a senator here from 1996 to, I think, 2004. He's a distinguished scholar, has a PhD. He's a distinguished professor now in residence at Wagner College, where he heads the Hugh L. Carey Institute of Government Reform. He's good enough to join us right now, I think, from a summer home out on Long Island. Good morning, Senator. Thanks for being with us.
Good morning, Fred. It's a pleasure to be on your program.
Great to have you. I've read about, I'd say, just about half of the book. I skimmed a lot of it and read seriously into other parts of it, and I think it's terrific. I strongly recommend it. Let me just quickly read a little.
Thank you very much.
Oh, well, my pleasure. I'm just reading a little bit here. In struggling to exert control over state spending, Carey vetoed a record 160 budget items during the 1980 legislative session. That, by the way, that sounds like small potatoes now, with Governor Patterson having just given about 7,000 vetoes. Mm-hmm. Just continuing, he limited annual state spending increases to less than 3%. Now, that's remarkable. Back then, too, we had some runaway inflation years, in striking contrast to the average state growth rate of 11% that had taken place during the early 1970s. And it says a big reason was his success in slowing growth of Medicaid funding of nursing homes, physicians, and hospitals. Where have we heard that before? You know, you read through the book, and I'm sure you'd agree, and since you were in the middle of a lot of it when you were here as a senator, it sounds like deja vu all over again, that history just has repeated itself, and we didn't learn those lessons sufficiently to make fundamental corrections that were learned in Carey's early years. What do you think?
I agree with you, Fred. We should have learned those lessons, because when Hugh Carey became governor, he did not know until after the election was over, and he defeated the incumbent Malcolm Wilson, who had been lieutenant governor to Rockefeller, and when Rockefeller became vice president, he succeeded him. No one told them, neither Rockefeller nor Malcolm Wilson, who served out the last year of the governor's term, what was awaiting him. It was a complete shock and surprise. And what was awaiting him was not the possibility, but the probability that New York City would go bankrupt. And Governor Carey felt that this would endanger the state of New York, which could also become bankrupt. And in sort of a domino effect, it could endanger every state in the union. And therefore, he sought to receive support from the federal government through his former friend, President Gerald Ford, a Republican. He was a Democrat.
Yeah, he knew him in Congress, right?
He knew him in Congress. Gerald Ford was the minority leader of the Republicans in the House of Representatives when he became the vice president after Spiro Agnew was forced to resign. Now, if I may, this problem would have not only shocked but rattled other governors. Hugh Carey surprised many people in the state and the nation by rising to the occasion and doing things that no one anticipated or expected him to do, especially a little-known figure in his time on the national scene, who had been effective, who had been good, but had not been able to show his ability of rising to the most serious occasion until he became governor of the state of New York, elected in 74, and then the fiscal crisis of 75, which awaited him when he was inaugurated.
I'll tell you, you had some terrific interviews with Hugh Carey, who thankfully is still with us, and I especially, I just want to make an aside, love the chapter dealing with Carey's remarkable run for president in 1974 and his meetings with political bosses down in New York.
Governor.
Excuse me, what did I say?
A president.
Oh, president. That was 1980. He was thinking about it anyway.
He was thinking about it.
You're right.
And many
of course. But the 1974 narrative of what he had to do to take on Howard Samuels, who was the party's designee, and some of those meetings with party bosses. I guess he had Jerry Crimmins with him at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Terrific stories. I mean, what a storyteller Hugh Carey apparently still is. You met with him, was it 9 times, I think you say?
Yes. Actually, most of the interviews with the governor were by my co-author, Robert Palmer. But we had interviewed, we got some very interesting stories about the governor from people like today, Lieutenant Governor Dick Ravitch, Peter Goldmark, who was the budget director at the time, Felix Rowerton, and Steve Berger, Judah Gribetz, his chief counsel. And the important thing, I believe, is that all of these people agree that they were shook up, some of them, when they were appointed. Carey did not know many of them. He asked for the best people around because he knew that this was the most major crisis since the Great Depression. And everyone who we met with, and we met with about 45 key people who then became ambassadors and presidents of the Rockefeller Foundation and presidents of universities like Donna Shalala, et cetera, and Clinton cabinet members, no one at the time who was in an important position really understood the greatness of the man. He was able to rise to an occasion of major danger, and he selected the best and the brightest people possible, and he didn't give a damn as to what the political bosses cared. He owed them, as you said, nothing. All the political bosses at that time supported the candidacy of Howard Samuels, who was considered a shoo-in. I think only 4% of the people of New York had ever heard of New York State, not his district.
Sure.
I was in his congressional district. I'd ever heard of Hugh Carey. So he went out of his way to hire the best and brightest of people, and he pushed aside the usual demands of county leaders for a new governor, and he came up with a most unusual and superb group of deputies and assistants that I don't think any governor or very few governors in the 20th and 21st century have been able to do.
Well, I don't know. Al Smith had some outstanding people around him. He was
probably
the greatest governor.
Many times in the book, I compare Hugh Carey to Al Smith.
And Nelson Rockefeller had extraordinary people. The trouble is the policies he's put in place have ruined the state, and it really is
legacy. What I wanted to say.
Yeah.
I mean, Nelson Rockefeller initially sided with Ford and his two key advisors, or three key advisors, Arthur Burns, his economic advisor, and his chief of staff, who was, believe it or not, was Donald Rumsfeld, and Donald Rumsfeld's deputy was Dick Cheney. He sided with them by sloughing off this. But then when he realized the magnitude of the problem and the dangers facing the nation as well as the state of New York, he then became a spokesperson for Carey in Washington.
Sure.
Carey was almost alone initially. He had to convince his old colleagues in the Republican Party, who thought the world of him, there should be some assistance from the federal government, and Gerald Ford insisted, and in many ways rightly so, that New York had to show that it meant business by asking each group, whether they were bankers and businessmen or workers and labor unions, that they had to compromise and give up certain things for the common good. And they were able to do this because of the persuasiveness of Governor Carey and his key advisors, who were truly outstanding. I was amazed how well they did. And
Seymour, can I ask you something?
Positions afterwards.
Can I ask you something?
Sure.
Give me a chance to speak here, would you please?
Go ahead.
Thank you. One of the things that impressed me as a pretty young reporter down here was not only Hugh Carey and what he had achieved, but the caliber, as you're pointing out, of the people who were here, who really had, in many cases, national recognition for what they had achieved. And it's widely accepted, and I think deservedly so, that the Mario Cuomo administration that succeeded the Hugh Carey administration was very successful to the extent that Cuomo kept the Carey people in place.
That's true.
And then there was a disaster with the George Pataki administration, who brought in a much lower caliber of people, and to the extent that there were some good people, they were crushed because of Pataki's own insecurity about being overshadowed by talented people in his administration, something Hugh Carey did not have.
That is an excellent point. You're right. Mario Cuomo kept many of the good people and brought in many other good people, and George Pataki just wasn't strong enough or had the positive self-image needed to get people in areas who knew more than he did in order to say, you know, to work with the state as Governor Carey had.
Well, I'll tell you.
And for a politician or elected official, it's very, very difficult to appoint someone to a deputy's role who knows more about an issue than you do and tell him, take the ball, run with it, this is what I want to achieve. I'll support you down the line throughout everything.
Well, I'll tell you, I just loved reading about Hugh Carey's background. I was saying before you joined us that when I came down here, there was no internet, and there was no real easy way to do research on the background of somebody like Hugh Carey. You would have to check old clips. Generally, what I did and others did was just speak to people who had been around for a long time to pick up what we could. What's so valuable about your book, as you well know, is that to understand any kind of historical figure, and Hugh Carey is a historical figure, you really have to understand a lot about their background. You provide that, and the stories of his father's business success and problems in the Depression, the stories of his joining the U.S. Army Cavalry and taking care of horses down the street at a National Guard armory, and that picture you have of him,
right,
in 1942, I mean, that's one of the most extraordinary pictures, the most extraordinary picture I've ever seen of Hugh Carey. You get a sense of he had a dashing quality to him, and a thin man, a good-looking man, and then his courage in World War II, and after what he had gone through there and in his life, knowing that being able to deal with tough people in a political environment was in a way easy compared to what he had to deal with in the military. But one point I'm trying to get at here is you make it clear that Hugh Carey and his family were comfortable with the business world, had come out of the business world, and he understood the private sector. So many politicians today have no sense of that. And one of the most thrilling things that I experienced down here, Seymour, was covering the battle that went on, battles plural, between John Dyson, who was the son of a very wealthy family. I guess his father was one of the founders of one of the big loan companies. I forgot the company, but very well known, very wealthy, self-assured, headed what was then known as the State Commerce Department, battling Peter Burley, who was the scion of a very famous New Deal figure,
Adolf A. Burley, right,
who wrote The Modern Corporation, one of the most definitive, important books on modern corporation, and was an interesting figure in the State Department as well. That's a whole separate issue. But I watched Burley and Dyson, these two very bright scions of wealth and privilege, battled it out over what was more important. In effect, that was the battle. The industrial section, the private sector, GE, for instance, and Schenectady plant making and other plants making capacitors versus the environmental battle with Peter Burley and PCBs in the Hudson River. And that fight went on for a few years. The governor allowed it to go on. Ultimately, Burley lost. And I think, as you point out in the book, Carey is responsible for a lot of important commercial projects, industrial projects here in New York, including a transformation of Battery Park City, Times Square, things that governors since then have not been able to achieve.
And remember what he did in terms of Willowbrook.
No, very important.
He closed up a snake pit and gave an example to the other 49 states what should happen to people who need help, emotional help, mental help, and other things like that from the state. Totally changed it. He thinks that might be one of his greatest contributions to the state of New York, as well as rescuing New York from bankruptcy.
I have to say, as you know, one of the most extraordinary things in the book, it took my breath away, is that story, talking about Willowbrook, about Nellie Bly, who is an iconic figure to people who study the history of journalism, an early muckraker in the 1880s and 90s,
right.
This remarkable woman who went to... what was the name of the island back then? Was it Welfare Island or even before that, where there was a mental hospital?
Right.
And stayed there for 10 or 12 days and then wrote an expose on it. The fact that you bring out, I didn't ever know this, is amazing to me. Hugh Carey's mother had worked for Nellie Bly?
Right. Hugh Carey's mother was the most unusual woman before women's lips, so to speak. His father was an oil executive and businessman. And his brother, Ed Carey, who funded, you know, large parts of his campaign.
Sure, New England Petroleum is the company.
Right, right. Was a major businessman and in oil. And Carey, you know, sometimes worked for them as an attorney and as a businessman. And I think it's very important to realize that Carey rose in all his positions defying expectations. Remember, you mentioned his Army experience. He came in as a private. He left as a major. And I was told that when he was campaigning in Borough Park, a man ran out of his store and he ran to Carey and hugged him and kissed him and said, "He liberated me from Nordhausen concentration camp." And then in Congress, he rose. He defeated a Republican in a safe Republican seat. And he went on to defeat Republicans for seven terms. He served for 14 years. He even defeated, in his last race, the Republican candidate after redistricting to assure them of to assure the Democrats that his seat would remain Democratic. He surprised many people, and he also surprised them again when he became governor, and he was able to rise to every major crisis. You know, in a sense, even surprising, some of the new people he brought into government who have remained lifelong friends with him.
I'm not surprised by that. How did the book come about? Unfortunately, we don't have that much time left. This is going very fast. What was the impetus for writing this book?
Well, I discovered through the New York State Archives and people that there had been a lot written by and about Rockefeller and by and about Cuomo, but the man in between, who, you know, really rescued New York State from bankruptcy, has very, very little written about him. This was about 3 years ago, and I've known Carey. I was a college student when he was my congressman and worked for him then for many years, and I approached Governor Carey and members of the Carey family with the president of Wagner College, and we established the UL Carey Institute for reforming government, which I think he was really very, very happy to do. And then we discussed the possibility of doing a book about him. Now, what you have to realize, Fred, we had no idea in 2007 that within 1 year we would have this major recession and fiscal crisis. Throughout the book, we say that the fiscal crisis of 1975 was the greatest since the Depression. Now it's debatable which was greater, the one today or the one then.
Well, the crisis for the state was greater then.
As soon as we discovered that, we really redoubled our efforts. Rob and I worked day and night with the interviews, with the writing, with the editing, and with SUNY Press that published it.
Oh, it's great. When are you coming up here to have maybe a book signing party at one of the bookstores and stop by the Capitol so we could put you on the air again to talk more about it?
Well, as a matter of fact, there's a bookstore in Albany. I think it's called, a major bookstore called the Book House.
Yeah, sure.
Right. They want me to come sometime in August, and we're now working on those dates.
When you do it, see if
it's a pleasure to appear on your program again.
See if you could fit the appearance here with your appearance there, and we'll promote it because I'd love to speak to you again. Nancy Carey, as you know, is here in Albany, the daughter of Hugh Carey.
Wonderful lady.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And she had initially alerted me to your book. So, Seymour Lachman, let me congratulate you on the book. Former Senator, let me congratulate you as well for not being part of the Senate Democratic Conference these days. I don't think you'd enjoy it if you were, and I'm sure
that's
you know what
one,
I mean.
One of the major things I'm very grateful for that I left when this began to occur, and I didn't stay there until the snake pit that exists there now.
You got out just
it's
in time.
It's very, very sad because Kerry worked with the legislature, and they both worked out things together. It wasn't just the executive branch, but the legislative branch. And there's now total gridlock between both.
It's really sad to see, and it's unbelievable. Thanks once again, Seymour Lachman of Wagner College. It's great to have you with us. This is Fred Dicker live at the State Capitol. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back.